You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello there, and welcome to the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is episode number 3, in which I'll be talking to Mr. Dan Antopolsky. And this is very different to either of the ones we've had so far. I mean, of course, every comedian is a beautiful, unique snowflake, and none more so than the comedy wizard Dan. I think of him as a wizard because he's kind of peculiar and arcane in his comedy in a very exciting, frothy sort of a way. But at the same time, he's very like a magician, like a stage magician, in that we're going to be talking a lot about, not using these terms, but we're going to be talking about misdirection and how you can lead an audience up the garden path and get them to look one way while you're secretly changing the meaning of something somewhere else. So it's a really fascinating chat. I hope you're going to get a lot out of it. Dan's a lovely man, and we'll be mentioning the various things he's up to at Edinburgh this year during the show. So I hope you enjoy the chat. The show is another long one. I've had some great feedback from people, and a lot of you have said you don't mind it being long, and someone said that it slays train journeys, so that's fine, that's exactly what we're after. It's another one of about an hour, I think. Thanks for your feedback in general, I've really been appreciating that. It's great if you get in touch with me. You can do that at info@stuartgoldsmith.co.uk, or you can tweet me at comcompod. Feel free, if you're tweeting, to RT that, especially if you're a comedian with a large following. Big up the show and spread it around. A couple of people have done that. Thank you very much to Matt Green, Joe Lycett, Ben Vandervelde, Tony Cowards, and Sarah Milliken have all very kindly tweeted it. If you would like to join that illustrious team, which I'm calling the Super Goldsmiths, then by all means, if you want to be a Super Goldsmith, get out there and tell your followers to follow this and listen to these things. Hey, if you're a newer act and you get loads of people in, maybe I'll interview you. A little incentive for you there. Oh, that sounds cheap. I regret saying that. But, you know, it's nice if people know about the show, so keep bigging it up. And thank you for the feedback. Do keep sending me suggestions of people you'd like to see, or wild criticism. And I just suddenly envisage hundreds of people emailing me. Just stop talking at the beginning. That's probably best. There was an odd little moment in this show as well, which might be food for thought for some of you, where Dan mentioned the name of a specific comedy club or clubs about which he has little positive to say. And I didn't know whether I should leave that in. I don't want to censor my guests. But at the same time, I did laugh at it, and that somehow implicates me. And perhaps this comedy club or clubs is one that employs me. So fortunately, it didn't matter in the end, because I happened to loudly sneeze exactly when he said the name. But if you have a strong feeling that that's something bad that I've done, and I should maybe take a different path there, do get in touch. It's an interesting thing, and I've given it a lot of thought. Fortunately, as I said this time, a loud sneeze, so no problems there. Couple of special guests coming up. I'll tell you more about them soon when they're firmed up. But no comedian is more special than any other comedian. But the two people I've got in mind are hugely famous. So they are more special. That's just how it works. Finally, You can very nearly buy tickets for Comedians Comedian Live at the Edinburgh Festival, which is going to be lunchtimes at 12:30 at the Gilded Balloon on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays. I've got some fantastic guests lined up for that. The boy with tape on his face is going to come down. Rod Gilbert's going to be there. Josh Widdicombe is going to come along. Pappies and Abandoman. And I'm working on some others at the moment as well. So hopefully you'll come and enjoy that. You can't buy tickets just yet. Maybe you can by the time this has gone out. But you can buy tickets for my own show, which is called Stuart Goldsmith Prick. It's probably best to search on the edfringe.com website for Goldsmith, because they've censored the word prick because that's too rude for the people of Edinburgh. I'm really looking forward to that show. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So buy stuff, support the show, retweet it, tell everybody, and enjoy this chat with the fabulous Mr. Dan Antopolsky. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and I'm here with Dan Antopolsky, and we're in his dark cellar.
Hello, welcome to the nether place of my house.
Did you nearly say nether regions?
I did, yeah. Once you start saying nether, it's hard not to say regions.
It is, it's quite nether around here, which I like. We were in your kitchen a moment ago, and you suggested we'd
come... The land of light.
Yeah, exactly.
I beckoned you down, yeah. It's not really down at all, it's along, but it's sort of a pseudo cellar because it's got a small window.
And
I do keep people tied up in it.
And this is where you do your writing, or as you were telling me earlier on, this is where the nose picking happens.
This is where the nose picking happens. This is my overpriced Mac keyboard.
For the benefit of the listener, we're looking at an overpriced Mac keyboard.
Thank you. And so this is where I sit here in June and July, having made a load of notes throughout the year on my phone notes application. And then I convert those bullet points into paragraphs. And then there comes a mediocre show.
Is that your process? Is that genuinely it?
Yeah,
I couldn't tell if you're being dry then.
No, that's about it, yeah. I mean, I speak already implicitly in terms of the Edinburgh calendar, because that's how I've always worked. Mm-hmm. And I rely on Edinburgh to frighten me into creating a new hour of material every year. And I think I create an hour, sort of half of that from inspiration as I walk around, ideas. And then the other half comes from... You know, sitting down and bashing away at paragraphs.
This is
trying to make them elegant towards Edinburgh, June and July.
To make them elegant.
Yeah,
that's a lovely
to
way
make
of
them not it. Be awful to listen to.
This is excellent stuff, Dan. But I think we should go back to hello, because we've got a little bit of time. So
I misgauged the time of this interview.
No, that's perfectly fine. What I could do is I'll chop that bit back into.
Okay.
We'll leave a gap later on of 2 minutes. Well, I'll say. So, what's your process? Then we'll sit here drinking tea. So, to begin with, you are Mr. Dan Antopolsky, of the beard and the curly hair, the penetrating gaze.
These are all trademarked.
I was going to say before, I recently saw on your fabulous website, which is danantopolsky.com. There
yes.
we are.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Hey, man. Yeah. I saw the little thing on your website of the flash video you made, like the animation of your entire roll of... shots.
Photo shoot. Yeah. Shots. Yeah. That's
which
right.
is, it's breathtaking. And it's fascinating actually to see someone else's offcuts.
Yeah.
Because I never know what to do in a photo shoot. You sort of stand there. I do different faces all the time? And you do them with real pizzazz, real dynamism.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to get silly moments. Just for the listener, I did a photo shoot 2 years ago where I had a big magician's cape and it looked sort of overblown and ridiculous. And I had to kind of pull a sort of face to go with it. And the blessed thing about digital photography, which didn't exist sort of when I started doing Edinburgh, is that you can just snap away and make gigabytes of photos, and the ones you don't like you can then delete. So you can just stand there pulling faces for ages and ages.
And you really do
pictures. Yeah.
You really do pull a face. You've got a really good face for pulling faces.
Thank you.
I think that's meant complimentary.
Thank you.
So let's just sort of put you in the context of how you got into comedy and what sort of a comic you are. Because I was thinking about you earlier on. I was thinking you're someone with a fairly prodigious breadth of output, be it in stand-up or raps, and then there was the Dinks, and now there's Jigsaw, there's a sketch show. You're making an awful lot of stuff. And I wondered how it was that you first started and what it was that attracted you to comedy as a thing.
Well, it was in 1997 in June, and I think it was the 9th that I did my first circuit gig, and that...
You have clearly done a lot of interviews.
No, I remember that date because I was very excited to be doing stand-up, so that was a very sort of hallowed day for me when I stood on the stage at Purple Turtle in Essex Road in Islington.
Oh, yeah.
And faced down what to me seemed a terrifying audience and so on. And I had been at university with some chums, and some of them were doing open spot gigs, and I'd gone to see them doing gigs in London and glimpsed the circuit and sort of seen how you know, most open spots were awful and mad and had no, you know, reason to believe they could do stand-up. So the door was wide open. I understood, watching a couple of gigs, that you could just turn up, that was your qualification to start.
Sure.
And so I turned up, yeah. And once I started, after about five or six gigs, I was bitten by the bug and was sort of fell on it, yeah.
And had you ever had designs on a performative career as a younger man?
I think
I
probably fancied it just from vanity, you know, to have people look, you know, that part of performer is always there. But I wouldn't have ever connected wherever I was in practical steps to being a comedian. But then the question of how people become comedians is very fascinating to normal non-comedian interviewers, because they can't see how you go about walking along to the shops.
My God, what do you do?
One day, how does it happen that you're suddenly a comedian, you know?
Yeah. Had you been into comedy as a kid?
Seems now, in retrospect, fated, because I was very interested in, I've got all the things that we, like, I'm an 80s kid, so for me it was Ben Elton and Harry Enfield.
Lenny Henry,
I suppose, yeah. And all that crew, yes. Friday Night, Friday Live, and Saturday Live and Friday Night Live, I think it was.
And were you a person that would learn the sketches and remember them and go in and perform them for your mates the next day?
That's it, absolutely. And at university, we put on a few nights where we would do Fry and Laurie sketches, which seems sort of hilarious. Very provincial thing to do, but that's what occurred to us to do, to enact those sketches. Yeah.
That so still happens. A friend of mine was at a rugby club, Do, and her brother and some of his friends were performing We Are Clang.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Just from having seen them at Edinburgh, they were blown away and just cobbled together whatever they could remember.
Right. How lovely. What a nice thing. Yeah.
Well, it's nice that
to enter
that
the culture, yeah.
Tradition is going on.
Yeah.
So you got into doing stand-up. Now, this was kind of like proper stand-up, in inverted commas, at the time. What was your style when you first started? What sort of things did you do?
I think my first sets, I had poems. I had a little book which pretended to be the book of poems, because that was an acceptable prop on stage. But actually, it had the jokes in, because you can remember poems, because they are poems. Little rhymes, you know, rude poems. And
so that was the equivalent of you writing them on the back of your hand.
Yeah, which I still do. I have it, and you can see the ink fading.
Oh,
there.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
There we go. Brothers in this sin. But I just sort of did little poems and weird disjointed one-liners in between. I think I was enamoured of Harry Hill at that time and was trying to, kind of mess around. I think if I wanted to be grand about my early mission in writing, I did a linguistics degree and I had sort of looked at the process of understanding sentences in speech. And so I was quite technical about disrupting the normal. Anyway, everyone who's listening to this will think I'm a wanker.
No, not at all. This is why.
Is this what you're after? Yeah.
This is exactly what I'm
something
after.
Something technical.
That to me makes absolutely perfect sense. Yeah. If I looked at 50 comics and you were one of them and they said one of these guys did a linguistics degree, it would make perfect sense that it were you.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of geeky about that, and I definitely did sort of think quite consciously about how jokes were structured in terms not just of misleading people about a pun in the setup, but other ways of identifying assumptions that were made about what was being communicated and then wrong-footing those, you know.
Okay.
Assumptions of clarity or assumptions of, that registers of speech would go together or anyway.
Can you give us an example of the sort of thing you're talking about?
Well, there we are. I've talked a big game. Yeah.
I was going to say, obviously, Dan, I understand exactly what you mean, but for the benefit of the stupid listener.
Well, an early joke that I liked very much, which was, how did it go? It was, you know, when you get a pea on when you're trying to get a pea on a fork and you can't get a purchase on it and you end up chasing it all around the plate, well, you can't just throw money at the problem. So that was a sort of early joke which would divide audiences. And I did sort of think about how this idea was presenting itself as a logical idea and then it would just sort of wiggle off, yeah. And so I suppose that is an example of that.
So that's a misunderstanding. And I imagine part of the way that joke works is people are thinking P as in, oh, he means a different meaning of the word P here.
Yeah.
Expectation of a...
When you're telling a joke, the listener's mind is sort of racing ahead, forming hypotheses about where the pivot is.
Yeah.
What that's going to do the switcheroo, you know. So if you then abandon that whole pivot system
sure.
and then go somewhere else, then that can be sort of funny in a different way. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is, but then that all becomes another kind of joke. And as you know, as you advance, you, there are sort of first order, second order, third, you know, you just sort of get a bit more developed and
mm-hmm.
can mock things that you've,
sure.
you've understood thoroughly. You can then sort of spin.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Everything. Yeah. Comedy is just about making the audience be wrong about what they think you're going
to
say.
I tend to think that's a cardinal yeah. sin of open spots is to point yeah. out the structure of what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
They're, but they're really only scraping the surface of a,
yeah.
of a structural thing. Whereas, as you say, it can become much more sophisticated.
That's right. And that is a sort of glaring sociological fact of people in that position, which is that they aspire to technical mastery
yes.
because they don't have it.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why they say so many technical things, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talk about whether the audience got that or not, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or whether that was worth more.
Yeah, that's right.
So do you find that, or did you find that when you were writing, well, we'll talk about the writing of it, and I also want to talk about the reception of that kind of material. I mean, did you think when you were writing, was that process semiotically going through your head of going, right, I've got to find the pivot, I've got to do this, or is it just that you feel your appreciation of what's funny is such that to you that's one of the obvious tacks you can take? I'm not trying to trap you there
No,
my appreciation is enormous.
Brett. No. I suppose, like, at the end of the day, I talk about theory, but on some level, we're all doing these things instinctively, comedians, aren't we? Like, we're using our own reaction to the thought of the joke in our minds to determine whether or not we think an audience might agree. You know, and it's only ever might. You go to the gig and you can be wrong.
Sure.
But, I think, I can't even remember your question. I've started.
just about whether, oh, I'm going to forget it now. That's going to be awkward.
Try.
No, about whether you are writing the joke thinking, I'm going to do something quite clever technically here, or whether that exists as a framework within which you really work on instinct, and then you can maybe retroactively look at it and go, oh, that's what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think probably you do write a joke instinctively. Like, one can never remember how an idea plopped into one's consciousness. Mm-hmm. Like, you must find that. Mm-hmm. You can never remember the exact moment where you were Stuart Goldsmith who didn't have the joke about the gorilla, and then you were Stuart who did have that joke, you know. So that is always a mysterious
sure.
and fully formed, like the spontaneous evolution of an eyeball in nature is a mystery. You know, how could these interdependent parts sort of exist? But somehow that happens. Your brain does that instinctively. And then I suppose a technical understanding helps you accept, like, you have a lot of fledgling ideas that you reject as not passing mm-hmm. some kind of funniness criterion mm-hmm. or, you know, but you have ideas that are not funny yet, but you think they've got legs. And that might be because they satisfy some kind of structural thing where you think, oh yeah, that is a thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah.
So you were saying about, the trying to use yourself as a gauge for how fast an audience can think. I mean, I know exactly what you mean there. In that you use yourself as a kind of, okay, if I were listening to this.
Yeah.
At what point would I catch up with what was being thought?
But yeah.
Do you
and
find
one can often be wrong about that as well.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think there's a mistake I've made for longer in my career than one would expect. It's
sure.
a flaw,
yeah.
you know, beyond just being junior.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Where I forget how involved the writing process was, and I don't give the audience enough time in performance to get a joke, and then I think they didn't find it funny, get paranoid, and move on in a
defensive way.
And I continue to do this. I've intellectualized it, so I put the brakes on it. But actually, when I listen to recordings of my performances, I often find I'm talking very fast.
Yes.
And that actually, even as a listener, even though I wrote the jokes, I'm not able to just
to follow the steps that you're
handling. I can, but not pleasantly.
Sure.
You know, it is a rush sometimes listening to a Dan Antipolsky gig if he's not watching himself, because he'll just throw too many nouns and verbs at you,
yes.
which are designed to be a bit obscure, which is
sure.
supposed to be pleasurable, a treasure trove of knowledge that you have, but mm-hmm. passively and not actively, and remind you about copper sulfate or whatever, you know.
Yes.
So it comes from a bit of your brain, and then not give that information enough time to travel along the neural pathways to the front, you know.
Just mentioning that, yeah. the copper sulfate joke, I think was the first joke I ever saw you do.
Really?
I think I first saw you on 28 Acts in 28 Minutes.
Okay.
And you were,
oh,
and
I
was
show.
Just tickled. I was delighted.
Oh,
and I think part of that reason was that even though I wasn't a stand-up at that time, I'd been doing comedy, I'd been making people laugh on the street for a long time. And
right.
I felt like I had a fairly sophisticated sense of humour. Mm-hmm. And I really liked comics who were chucking things out so fast I could only just keep up.
Right.
And I think that's part of the attraction of someone like you, is that you are, the stuff is so dense, or can be so dense. I think deliberately.
But it mustn't be too dense. And you're a bright chap as well. So you can't expect... I mean, broadly speaking, you're a bright
chap. But, I didn't know how to respond to that. No, thank you, Dan.
Compared to some audiences, you can't assume that everyone is sort of eager and B, alert.
For the benefit of the listener, can you tell us the... I mean, you can't do that joke, though, because we know the punchline, but what's...
Well, the joke is very simple, since we're in an academic conversation. Yeah. There's no harm in... No, the joke is, what is white when dry, blue when wet? Copper sulfate. So it's sort of an anti-joke, yeah.
And I particularly remember the way you would perform it would be to sort of... It was just such a surprise. Yeah. Copper sulfate, as if you were expecting
everyone
to... As if
it were a cheesy musical pun. Yeah, that's right.
So when you're trying to gauge... Yes, do you find that process... That's what I was going to ask you. Mm. Do you find the process of putting yourself in the shoes of the audience member? Do you think over time there is kind of a smudge, there's a change... I think what I'm trying to say is you presumably are much faster and more comedically sophisticated than the average audience member.
One would hope so.
So do you find that you play the role of Joe Punter when you're thinking, okay, at what point do I get this? At what point might a punter catch up with this? At what point might 30% of the room or, and is there a point, okay, and by now 100% of the room will be behind this concept?
I suppose so. I think that is not me, but that's a general sort of comedian's thing, that your ultimate goal is to communicate. And even if you're being deliberately difficult or deliberately nutty professorish or something where the audience is supposed to understand part but not all, mm-hmm. or that there's a pleasure of being a bit baffled, you know, or feeling like there's a runaway train going off the rails or something like that, or even that you're watching an autistic persona who's pleasing themselves, you know, that can all be a pleasure. At a kind of character comedy level, almost, you know. But at some point, you have to be able to communicate one of these things.
Yes.
Otherwise, nothing is happening.
Yes.
In theatre, it's a wanker. Yeah. So it's very upsetting if you have gigs where people think you're a wanker because they didn't follow you where you were trying to... You were trying to, lead, like a will-o'-the-wisp, you're trying to sort of dance a bit out of their way and they're trying to be behind you so that...
Sure.
So that they think you're a magic man and that's a fun thing to think.
And yet sometimes you're just annoying flashing light.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's a balancing act that is why comedy's an art. Because if it was simple and could be written down and an actor could be taught to do it, then there'd be nothing to be a comedian. And we all know that... Like, how long have you been doing stand-up now?
About 5-6 years, yeah.
Five, six years. Okay. Well, you know the process is ongoing, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's quite slow.
I think I have to comfort myself with that sometimes. That you go, well, you know, when you're stuck on something, I try and think to myself, well, of course this isn't easy. If it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
That's exactly right.
Of course,
right.
At the moment, everyone is doing it, but we can only hope it stays difficult enough to...
No, that's right, yeah. But, I mean, when you start, there's a very steep learning curve, and then it kind of trails off as it must. And if you look at Rich Hall or someone who's doing it not merely 10 years, but I guess 30 years, then he's that degree... Or Stuart Lee, who's been doing it, I suppose, 25 years, you know. Uh-huh. I couldn't begin to write his stand-up.
No.
You know. Yeah.
Did you think you would be like the kind of comic that you are? Did you have an idea in your head of the sort of comic you would be, and how does that match up with the kind of comic that you are now?
You mean at the very beginning?
Yeah, as an example, I used to go and see Simon Munnery a lot, and I thought, I'm going to do comedy, and I'm going to be just like Simon Munnery. Sure. And of course, I couldn't be more different from that.
No.
You know, in approach,
in demeanour,
in intellect,
and
in demeanour, in everything. But I just wondered...
He's quite a challenging person to seek to emulate.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah.
For anyone.
But
yeah.
I think that's it. I don't know that I was seeking to emulate him. I just thought this is what the best comedy is.
Yeah, sure.
So that's
how we feel when we start, is that is we feel like there are authentic ways to do it, or there's a truest way to do it. And when I started in 1997, Harry Hill, Eddie Izzard, and then my peers. And like when I went around this, I remember seeing Sean Locke for the first time at Up the Creek and just thinking, oh my God, I didn't know it was possible to be this sort of effortless.
You feel that simultaneous mix of...
So simple seeming and yet so you know, current-ish, you know, and it was so exciting, yeah. And so as soon as one starts, whoever one looked at as a model quickly gets, you know, there are all these gods and demigods that sort of inspire you, and you try on their hat for a while, see how it fits, and then you maybe shed it, you know. It's sad when somebody keeps sort of talking. Yes. You know, there are some people
who... Yeah, we've all seen that happen,
I think. We've all seen that happen, naming no names. Yeah, there are people who are sort of stuck in this kind of trope way of performing, where you feel that their own personality is not being expressed.
Yeah.
And that's limiting.
It's kind of a trap, isn't it? Yeah, because it's a trap, because I suppose it puts... It generates a kind of a comfort zone that you're really only going to evolve when you can. I mean, they're mentioning no names. There is an act who's very like a famous act that I know, and he'll do his thing, and you kind of go, oh, okay, well, it's kind of worked. There it is. And then in the car afterwards, this specific person, he just started telling me stories from his own life, and I just felt like shaking.
And he's a witty person.
Do this. Exactly. This is so unusual and new and daft, you know.
But people go down, they go down a road, and they, I mean, when once you get professionally comfy and earn a living, and then who knows, maybe have kids and need to maintain income, you know, you can be trapped, and it's a problem, you know, for people who've got a two-dimensional persona that doesn't allow for their real changes as they age.
Sure.
And there are some comedians who are like Radio 1 DJs, like, these 50, I don't know how old David Kidd Jensen is. I can't listen to him. It sounds like death.
Yeah.
It sounds like, it's like a fossil of an earlier decade speaking in those cadences, you know. And, I mean, comedy, should be expressive. And that is only possible if it's allowed to reflect who you are at any one moment.
Yeah. I think one of the things I really enjoy in having these chats and recording these podcasts is being reminded that there is more to it than, you know, the daily grind of being a comic and having to write jokes and get on with it and do it and produce the stuff and put the mileage in.
Yeah.
You can end up kind of feeling, oh, we're just a bunch of turns. And then when I have one of these chats, it's so refreshing to hear, to be reminded just, oh no, there's all this stuff going on. Just with the way you're talking about currents and like this sort of the dance, the interplay of the rhythm of your performance and the words that you're saying.
Yeah.
To remember that there is so much more to it.
And one does get jaded, and one can forget that one was once very inspired by people who were very good at it, as one was inspired by sportsmen or anyone else that had an impressive skill. You know, once you acquire some skill, you know, some basic stagecraft, you can sort of feel that it's a bit of a, well, you can feel it's a craft and lose touch with the fact that it's an art, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, comics are awful. I mean, the life decision that they initially made to sort of have a creative lifestyle has been completely sold for a kind of, I don't know, a comfort and salary and a kind of deluded affirmation of their peers. And it's this very malign little Oxbow Lake where, and I don't mean professionally, I don't mean they're only earning 80 grand, earning £1 million, you know, but they're creatively, they've sort of gone forward to a point and then just settled, you know. What I still feel is the attraction of comedy.
Which did you
is
ever
that
do?
You can mix it up, give something a poke, see if it moves and break things, just, you know, because even if they're not broken, you can fix them just to see what happens, you know.
Sure.
And that's precious. And that's something I'm finding now working with Jigsaw. Perhaps we'll talk about current projects later, but I'm working with Tom Crane and Nat Letsema writing sketches. And we are now, like last year, we did our first Edinburgh show and we were presenting written scripts to each other and then tentatively correcting them. And now we're rude to each other because we know each other.
Yeah.
And we're just sort of being very silly, and sketches can start one way and they can totally go off another way. We completely have an idea about the sketch that is we tried out a couple of times, only the bit in the middle got any laughs. So we think, oh, maybe that's the funny bit. So maybe he's not a professor, maybe he's a milkman. And we just go off. And so that's very nice that things can be endlessly refreshed, like an etch-a-sketch, just sort of wiped.
Sure.
And,
So we'll talk about sort of collaboration then. So you work with the Dinks. Now, I never saw the Dinks.
Sure.
Was that a sketch show or was that a group of different stand-up things? Just tell us a little bit about that and we'll put Jigsaw in the context of that.
Certainly. The Dinks was two Edinburgh shows and associated prep in 2003 and 2004. And it was me and Tony Law and Craig Campbell, both of whom are brilliant stand-ups in their own right. and it was an adventure story. So I suppose our model was the Bush Edinburgh shows, mm-hmm. where they'd had the Bush boys in the Arctic or whatever. So the first show, I think, was the idea was I was an Englishman. We had this little audio introduction about how an Englishman had fallen out of a plane crash and landed in this mm-hmm. yard in Alberta, Canada, with these two backwards types.
Okay.
And then we were trying to share a yard, and then we all fell out, and then aliens came, and then so it was sort of, extended sitcom type.
Sure.
Show with songs and that sort of thing, and very silly, and Craig threatening us physically.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can imagine you and Tony Law being naturally drawn together in terms of style.
Yeah.
And Craig Campbell, who I think is a phenomenal
amazing
stand-up,
comedian,
I think
of
him, he's like a bear. Do you know what I mean? I think the very first conversation he and I had was about what you should do if a bear was chasing you.
He takes those conversations very seriously.
He really does.
If any listener ever encounters Craig, you know, even if you've never met him before, ask him about the difference between huskies and malamutes, and he'll assume you've got a good reason for asking and talk for 45 minutes very interestingly on the subject. Yeah.
But that's a very different sort of a style. His stand-up is a very different style to yours and to Tony. So what was the genesis of that, of you guys working together?
Well, Craig was from an earlier way. I mean, Craig supported Jim Carrey when he still did arenas that, you know, of a size that we might relate to, you know. So Craig has been doing stand-up for quite a long time.
Jesus, yeah.
And had a TV show in Canada, was kind of a star there. So Tony was a fan of Craig's,
mm-hmm.
and Tony had sort of done stand-up mainly in Britain. So although he was Canadian, he was really a British mm-hmm. comic in the sense of his traditions.
Sure.
And so that's how he knew of Craig. I didn't really know of Craig, but we all got on initially. And then so we did the show. And then eventually, like any group of three men, we all decided we wanted to kill each other and stop working together.
I think in a situation
they were very nice.
If I was in a room with Craig and he wanted to kill me or I wanted to kill him, I would leave that room.
For example. Yeah. But it's a funny thing. Collaboration is very difficult. And I mean, this podcast is going to hang around, and who knows what's going to happen with Jigsaw. You know, maybe,
it
will all succumb to bitterness and McCartney Lennon hatred, you know. But that was quite grand. Inspirational. But at the moment, we sort of feel like it's a very healthy dynamic, which I mean, the Dings was great. We did some funny, like the first show was very funny. The second show, we were sort of starting to fray, and I think it was not as good. But anyway, and then we stopped. But I think three men is difficult, and especially three stand-ups, all of whom are
absolutely.
You know, however much they smooth over, they're sort of alphas. You know, mm-hmm. it is hard to share. And with Jigsaw, I'm nearly 40 and Tom is 30, so we're different mm-hmm. beasts, and Nat is a lady. Mm-hmm. So, like, there just isn't
a very different beast.
A very different beast indeed, yeah. So there isn't this, there seems to be, hopefully, less potential for friction.
I think stylistically as well, I would imagine you're much more compatible in terms of the things that make you laugh.
More complementary.
More complementary,
I would say so, yeah, I guess so, yeah.
And I mean, I can only talk about, I saw Jigsaw last year. I saw you do some warm-up stuff at Old Rope, and then I saw your show, which I thought was just, I mean, I don't want to say it's ridiculous.
No.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You sound like an interview going, I saw the show, loved it. I mean, I thought it was great. Yeah. And what I loved was like you said, it was kind of, even then, it looked like you had done a bunch of stuff, taken all of the funny bits and dropped everything else.
We
and just
cut
did
hard. Yeah.
Hundreds and hundreds of really funny things, really
Thank
fast.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, that was our intention. We worked very hard on the show, and I think it was 44 tiny sketches in 50 minutes, by the end. So it was like really pared down to ideas, So it was kind of the equivalent of like a one-liner comic, I suppose. And, we hadn't seen that done anywhere else. And that was not our original intention to do short sketches, but that was how it evolved. That if we made the sketches short, they would be funnier and the whole flow of the sketches would be better because the audiences would know, even if a sketch wasn't the best, you know, there's always greens and ambers and reds, you know.
Sure, whatever, sure.
Then they would still be on board with us because they knew another idea they might prefer would be along in a minute. So there was a tremendous good. We hardly had hard shows. We had like one show where it was Old People Tuesday.
Yeah, okay. And we've done Mervyn Stutter.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. So that was hard, and maybe a couple of others. But like generally in an Edinburgh run, there's like a third mm-hmm. where it's work, mm-hmm. you know, and then there's a third that are gold, and then in the middle there's, you know. So it was a very performable show.
It reminds me now you said about the getting to the punchline and then moving on. It reminds me of Tom Basden's approach to comedy songs. I don't know if you saw his
show. I've seen
he got nominated for or won the Perrier with his show Won't Say Anything, which he didn't speak, but he did comedy songs with no choruses.
Right.
He did the funny bit and then got out and did another one and ended up doing sort of 100 of them. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
Having done a little bit of sketch stuff myself with Richard Sandling in the show Kiosk of Champions.
Yes.
I think we really fell prey to let's keep going because it'll get funny again rather than.
But it depends. I mean, it depends. It depends what the dynamic is. It's not the only approach. I think, I mean, for Jigsaw, it was the, I regret to say I didn't see your show with Richard, but I know you're both funny and, you know, I'm sure that on nights when it worked, it was charming to watch you kind of flailing around.
I'm sure
that was very funny, you know.
Yeah. And we were likened to a biplane circling King Kong.
That's great. What a nice feeling for the audience. I would see that show. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. But we're sort of writing our second generation of material now, and it seems to be changing tone away from punchlines and a bit more into kind of, it's still tightish, but we're more confidently hanging the silly moments rather than feeling we need to make haste. Mm-hmm. For a joke.
Rob Deering had very specific feelings about how and where he finds his social life, given that he's gigging most nights and has a family.
Yeah.
And obviously he performs almost entirely as a solo. Do you find that working with Nat and Tom, it sort of changes your social life or your communality?
I suppose so. I mean,
I'm saying is, Dan, I'm terribly lonely as a comedian.
I'm very lonely as a comedian. Yeah, and as a father. I mean, I love my children, but one is sort of squished out of shape when one has kids, and you don't. I mean, my younger child is five, so the last year or two, I've been going out for a beer, and that's not misogynist.
Yeah.
So, honey, I'm off. You know, and. Yeah, but it is very nice to have a beer with Tom and Nat after the show and a bit of a post-mortem and for it to blur with, you know, being in a pub, actually having a beer. It feels, you know, it's quite nice. But there isn't enough time in the day. And when you have kids, there's no time. There isn't even remotely enough time. So that is hard. That's the hard bit when you become a comic. Because when you're in your mid-20s or whatever and you start, it's very exciting and you're meeting everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting everyone, your peers, you know, gently competing against them for advancement, you know, and then having car journeys with people you've admired and mm-hmm. getting to know them. And so socially, it's a great world. And that was my first few years of comedy were a golden period in my life where I just was so in love with it. I was so, I had no thoughts for anything else. All my waking moments were thinking about it. And, life has other plans. So it's difficult. Yeah. I don't know if this would be candid and not maudlin, but like, I passionately love my children, but there's an enormous wrench from a life one had chosen where one had a lot of liberty.
Sure.
And pottered about with ideas percolating gently in the back of one's head and then felt a desire to do some creative work arise and naturally followed one sort of biorhythms, you know. And now I get up at 7:30 and take my kids to school, you know, reluctantly.
If you must be educated.
So these others kind of productions. Yeah. So anyway, it's tricky. But anyway, here we are doing it. So it's happening.
I think, I wonder about how people plan their comedy career, because it's one of those jobs where I think it's very, very difficult to plan what you're going to do as a comedian. And I think whenever I try and plan my future, I suppose I'm always subconsciously planning a baseline of a minimum
wage from a minimum involvement with comedy should I then have children, and
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to sort of plan for plan for the worst. Obviously, no, no, I imagine no. I would also love my children, but no, in no. terms of the time that's being taken up,
yeah.
you can hope for just incredible. The sky's the limit with comedy, as we know, yeah. movies and so forth.
Mm.
But I try and plan for how will I still be happy doing this when I'm 45?
Yeah.
How will I still be happy doing this when I'm 50?
Yeah.
And do
well, that's smart, yeah. Because yeah. travelling to Sheffield on a rainy Tuesday is not for a 50-year-old.
No.
Probably.
No.
I mean, it's a funny thing about comedy that we still don't know what happens to comedians when they get old from our little world.
Yes, because it's such musical, a new thing.
Yeah, like yeah. the old star comedians, they still stand on stage in a bow tie at age whatever.
Mm.
Doing gigs to people their age, but those the Comedy Store players are still only in their 50s, aren't they? You know, yeah. the Alexi Sale or whatever.
Yeah.
So we don't know what the roadmap is. So we better get a an idea of where the, yeah. where the money's coming from. Otherwise, we're going to have to do yeah. some quite undignified things at the wrong age.
I worked with a comic recently who was coming back to it after years away,
mm.
and I think that's quite an interesting thing. I remember I was chatting to another comic at the time, kind of saying. That's got to be, you really got to have nerves of steel to do that. I've got the greatest respect for anyone that
mm.
that stops, has kids, comes back to it. And what do mm. you do? Do you do your old stuff? Do you,
yeah.
right, you know, how do you sort of reconnect with things? You took a brief hiatus. You took a,
from Edinburgh, yeah. Three years off, yeah.
Yeah.
While my kids were small. I just couldn't do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, so I came back and had to kind of start again a bit. Not to... But I had changed. I mean, fatherhood changes you, obviously. You know, it's a big, big experience and gives you new things to talk about. And so my comedy's kind of changed now. So all that stuff we said about my approach to joke writing is partly still the case, but partly a bit historical and still sort of
okay.
is the most of my career. But I think I'd try and speak a bit more candidly now. And the further I go on, I think the more I try and write that stuff that your friend said in the car, you know, just mm-hmm. like... funny, engaging stories.
Mm-hmm.
Let's
talk about that then. Let's yeah. talk about the types of things you find funny, the types of things you notice that you think that will be mm. that could be useful or fecund somehow. Do you spot a type of things in yourself? Do you ever, I don't know, it's a huge subject. Do you ever mm. come up with stuff and go, that's not really me? Or is absolutely anything fodder?
I think anything should be fodder. I mean, my idea with writing Edinburgh shows is to always do pack them with variety and do a song and then a rap and then a thing, so you just don't know what's coming next.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that purely so that the audience doesn't know what's coming next, so the audience, to keep you entertained as well?
Well, but it amounts to the same thing in terms of us, you know, you and the audience warming to each other, that enthusiasm is maintained. I don't know, when my heart sinks, it's because... a well-written show on an arc can be wonderful as mm-hmm. a piece of writing, but people who, I don't know, you wouldn't ask Eddie Izzard to stay on topic. You wouldn't ask sure. Sean Locke to stay on topic.
No, sure.
You know, so I don't know, I feel offended, not offended, yes, offended, and disappointed when my Edinburgh shows are reviewed as being bitty.
You know, yes.
That he has failed to commit to a theme because I have, yeah.
You're actively ditching the idea of a theme and coming up with a big bag of your funniest
I hope so,
stuff.
Yeah, because yeah. that's what makes me happy. I mean, and shows that, like Tony Law, who I used to work with, who we were talking about, I've seen two of his recent shows and they've been so delightful.
Mm-hmm.
They've been just so funny from a great comic zipping around, you know. From idea to idea, and there is no problem for me with that, you know, and it either tickles you or it doesn't. Some audiences mm. come to my shows and they like it more than others. Anyway, blah, 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 blah.
I think it's strange that the more successful stand-up becomes as an art form, or the more used to it everyone gets, the less alternative it becomes, if you like. I think that's when there becomes a model in a reviewer's mind of what makes an Edinburgh show.
Yeah.
And I think there becomes a model in comics' minds of
mm.
what I have to do at Edinburgh to get noticed or yeah. to be on the table somehow. So
that's right.
And I
mean, it's weird. It's a weird idea. It's a media idea. It's not a comedic idea, the idea of trends, you know.
Mm.
Isn't it? I mean, we are all sort of in a zeitgeist. So something that I mean, I generally look down on reviewers compared to comedians. I think just because you've watched a few hundred shows is not the same as having done a few thousand shows.
Or even done one.
Or even done one. Yeah, that's right. It looks very different from the inside than from the outside.
Sure.
So mainly I don't have a lot of time for reviews.
Do you read them? Or do I you do, go I, out of your way to avoid them?
I do read them, and then sometimes I regret to...
I'm that one.
Yeah. But, I mean, what reviewers are placed to do something that comedians aren't, which is to spot trends. You know, if you go and see 100 shows at a festival and everyone's talking about monkeys, then they'll, you know, you can sort of say, oh, well, this is a thing.
It's an article this year on monkeys and an article next year on what happened to all the monkey
stuff. Yeah, exactly. But, I don't know, Nat Lertzema was interviewed for Jigsaw by a journalist who began his interview, Sketch is dead. Why do you think... Blah, 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 you know.
Wow.
And he was saying it to be abrasive and provocative, I suppose.
So that she'd go, Sketch isn't dead. And he could quote, Sketch isn't dead.
Yeah, or whatever. To put her on the back foot is a silly man. Yeah. But anyway, okay. So Sketch is dead. I mean, on what level is Sketch dead? When we have a bad gig, maybe Sketch isn't dead.
Yeah, sure.
If we have a good gig, surely Sketch isn't dead. So like things are so basic. Like telling stories is basic. Writing one-liners is basic. Doing a sketch, which is like more than one performer expressing an idea over a length of time, and then another one, and then another one. That's basic. So all these things are just sort of bits of Lego, and the idea that they have trends is strange. You know?
The whole concept of trends could fall away without really affecting...
Without affecting anything, yeah. It's a post-match analysis, yeah.
Do you ever try and put yourself in environments where you think you'll come up with stuff?
I don't. I downloaded an app I found helpful recently. It's called Word.
Environment for Stimulating Comedy. Where can I get it?
No, it's just it's a random word generator. It generates an adjective and a noun.
Okay.
Lopsided affluence, unhappy camel. And that's quite good, you know, because often one can get settled in tram lines and one needs, sort of random stimulation to set one off on new pathways. But I don't really go to a place, no. I suppose I should. I'll get around to that.
Yeah. I had a great time in an airport the other day.
Did you?
I could just walk around and there was no one there.
Yeah.
I had nothing to do and I definitely couldn't do anything and there were no distractions.
Mm.
And I wandered around Alicante Airport for about an hour and a half and I'm sure I wrote 10 good jokes.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It'll probably turn into 2 good jokes.
Sure. That's good. That's still a decent rate, yeah.
And I did at the time. I'm sort of desperate to not be sat looking at a blank piece of paper.
Yeah.
But whenever anything like that happens, I then start planning the rest of my life around being in airports a lot.
Do you know what I mean?
How can I make sure I'm always just waking up in an airport lounge? Yeah.
I think that would then become a pattern. You'll have to start going to mechanics yards and other places.
Yeah.
But I think the blank piece of paper is not at all frightening when you have a deadline. The deadline is more frightening than...
Oh.
Yeah, so that's
I'll be quoting that in the blurb for this. That's a really good idea. That's a really good point, yeah.
Well, that's why Edinburgh is useful, because it's... I think what keeps you from creating is the fear of... is perfectionism, is the fear of doing something mediocre. Not even doing something crap. That would be kind of likable, but of doing something mediocre.
The dreaded
three-star review, yeah. The emotionless three-star review.
It's comedy. Yeah. There it is.
No, that's right. Yeah. So when you have a deadline, the mother of my children is a poet, and she did a show with a director, a sort of theatrical show, and the director gave her a maxim, which was, let it be the pathetic piece of shit it was always meant to be. And I find that completely inspiring, because you've got to let yourself off the hook and make a start, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what's really nice about working with Jigsaw, is that there's something about three people on the stage, or two even, that's already charged. There's already a situation. There's already a relationship. There's something to watch before you even open your mouths. So it takes the pressure off things, and it allows you to feel more relaxed about exploring them. And, yeah, I don't know. If you're writing an Edinburgh show and you've got half an hour and you need 55 minutes, that 55 minutes in a funny way already exists. It's not written yet. But the fact that you've got this container to pour the liquid into kind of instantly frees you up, because you've got to do it, you know.
Yeah.
And you're just filling in. Yeah. It's already a show. I mean, the way the calendar works, as you know, you write your marketing blurb, you describe the show, which doesn't exist yet. Yeah. You have a poster that sort of suggests the show. So it is sort of a concept. I mean, you can say those things are flimsy, but actually they become kind of real because it's like a title of a book. It then dictates, once you've settled on that, it feeds back into whatever you're doing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when in the year do you accrue that kind of half an hour?
Start getting frightened.
Yeah. Well, I guess so. At what point does the fear set in? So it's September last year. You've just finished your Edinburgh run. You're maybe touring that show.
Yeah.
At what point do you start thinking, oh God, I've got to do another one? Do you think, oh God, or do you think,
I suppose,
hooray,
the new,
I get to
I suppose the
one.
New year, yeah. I suppose the new year, yeah. But then I mean, ideas just come up and you try them in gigs, you know, little remarks.
So then you get to the new year. Yeah. You start to think about, right, okay, what's it going to be this year? Or you're to try and pick out things from the last couple of months worth of notes. And do you find that you don't, I mean, when do you put pen to paper on that initial 30 minutes? Is that before you've got to put the blurb in? Or at what? Because people have got very different things. I sort of want to have half an hour by Christmas, even if I don't use it, just so I can feel ahead of the game. Because otherwise, I'll panic and I won't sort of cope with the stress of it all.
Yeah.
But then I think some people, I mean, you know, there's a famous.
Some people thrive on different, on different levels of stress, don't they?
Yeah. So is it kind of April and you think, right, let's get this together and start previewing it, or later?
I think a couple of early previews. I mean, you've got, like, preview season is a whole experience where it's embarrassing because it's crap. You know, your show is crap. It's just not ready. You know, and you're standing on there with a barefaced cheek of doing unheated tea. So that is good to have lots of little deadlines that break up the impact of the big asteroid of Edinburgh that's sort of hurtling towards Earth, yeah. I've never done it, but I know that people are sometimes still writing their show. It's probably changed now. The festival's got so expensive and competitive. I don't know that there, but there's a couple of perfectly good and established comedians who start writing their show in July, and I just don't know.
I have no idea
how you. I don't know how you, that you wouldn't be sick every day.
And you mentioned the barefaced cheek of being there with undercooked stuff.
Yeah,
and I think that in every gig situation, let's say you're doing a 20 somewhere.
Yes.
You're doing a closing 20 or a 30 in October.
Yeah.
Are you chucking new little bits in there?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
I mean, a sadness that comedians know, that you'll know, is when you have an old routine and you suddenly, like 2 years on or a year on, find a bit that elevates it to funny. Yeah. But it's kind of part of the old corpus. Yeah. Work, so you're not allowed to use it again, at least at the festival. You can use it in clubs. So,
well, let's talk about this, because that seems to me to be the rule. You go up there, you do your hour, and in order to prove that you're credible, next year you have to do an entirely different hour.
Yeah.
There are, I think, there's the more American kind of way of doing it, which is that you come up with your best bits.
Yeah.
And I think some British acts subscribe to that. I know Mickey Flanagan did a show where the following year there was 15 minutes in it from the previous year, because it was just such golden stuff, and it had become a standard and people wanted to see it.
Yeah.
And I do, I kind of find I write all year, I go to Edinburgh, and then I've got a bit about the fear of flying from last year's show, and it was in the middle of last year's show, and it was sort of average, it was nice, and then since then I'm closing with it.
Yeah.
And now I've brushed it up and it's really rocking, and I want to take it back next year, but I feel like there's this unspoken agreement.
A nasty reviewer will say,
well, he's resting on his flying.
Well, that's it. An uncomfortable choice. Yeah.
But you're very much of the school of a brand new hour.
Yeah. I mean, only for fear of, being thought to be unproductive. Yeah. I suppose
a massive loser.
Yeah. Massive. I think it has sort of changed as well. Like, I started, my first festival was 97, doing open spots or whatever. And then I know that it was form then to sort of have at least 10 minutes of old stuff generally, like Adam Bloom and sort of big Edinburgh names of that period were kind of doing a degree of old stuff. But I think the culture has sort of changed now.
So is this feeling you need to prove you can come up with the goods year on year?
Yeah, I suppose so. And to go every year, otherwise it kind of creates the impression that you're struggling to come up with an hour, yeah. I mean, you know, one sense of who's a prolific, like Mark Watson, a famously prolific person, seems to always have six things on the go, and you kind of feel like you want to catch them all because he'll be whizzing off doing something else, and if you missed it, it's gone, you know. So, and the other end of the spectrum is people who, very circuity comics, who might do the occasional Edinburgh show, and you sort of feel like you've seen it, and you just have no feeling of an occasion. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I don't know, but Edinburgh is special for the fact that people come up with new work, and that is, you know, regardless of how good it is, that gives it its energy. That there is risk, you know, everyone who's written a new hour, no matter how many previews they've done. I mean, we previewed Jigsaw very thoroughly. You know, we never.
You did hundreds last year.
We did, about 30 previews, you know, which is more than I've ever done before, yeah. But even recently, I've done sort of 20, which is a lot, you know, it's like a little tour mm-hmm. before you do Edinburgh. Because, yeah, well, it just isn't. So many good things can come out of the Edinburgh Festival in industry terms. And even if they don't, a hard Edinburgh is something I wouldn't wish on anyone, you know.
Yeah, God.
It's horrible. It's fatiguing enough when everyone's clapping. Mm-hmm. And if you're kind of getting crappy reviews that are upsetting and make you feel vulnerable every day, then that's, you know, you can imagine just leaving.
Yeah.
You know, it's just too, it's just too unhappy. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Every time you see a stand-up do a word-perfect sentence, you know on some level, no matter how conversational his, you know, style is, that there is another event that took place in the past that was the creative event, and you're watching a trace of that event. And then there's a live event as well, which is his performance of it, and if that's done with intelligence and commitment and, and he's got an approach, then that is a live event. But, you know, so like some people think that Ross Noble is the only comedian because everything that happens is sort of created in the moment. And I've felt seduced by the idea of complete liveness and improvisation, but I've kind of settled into a middle area where there is this depth of thought you can have at the writing desk. You can write something, squint at it, cross it out, write it again. And then for that to interact with the live event, I think is what I like in stand-up, where, oh, God, I'm so pompous. But
not at all. I'm loving this.
Because my hero, like, I'm enjoying Louis C.K. at the moment. He's speaking to me about my life and fatherhood and sort of ambivalence in that chapter of life where I am now. So I laugh with great recognition at that. But also, he's a great comic for me for the same reason Sean Locke and Stuart Lee are great comics, because they're live performance is about the politics in the room. It's about prodding the audience and creating a political, in the, you know, real sense of the word, that it's about people in the room, about the power between where that is between the performer and the audience, and questioning the authority of the guy who's holding the mic, you know, and all of those things are in play. And that makes the live event, you know, very, very very interesting. And layered. And if I keep talking, probably a full stop will come.
I think that's a very good point. I think it's about the dynamic between the live and the rehearsed. And I think you're exactly right. Because one of the things I associate with Louis C.K. is his absolute searing honesty.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I really aspire to that level of honesty. I don't know if I'd ever get there. He can just say anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think of his classic old opening bit about how he's really glad that he's white.
Yeah.
And that's just such a completely underpinning idea.
Yeah.
That I think he's someone who's got that thing nailed between the writing desk.
Where the audience trusts him so completely.
Yeah. The ideas are there, it's rigorously thought out ideas.
Yeah, that's right.
Being then kind of improvised or re-improvised, which I think is obviously a long way away from a funny thing happened to me once.
No, that's right.
And then pulling back and going, oh, I didn't mean that.
No.
What am I doing?
No,
that kind of thing.
I mean, he writes, I was reading some Christopher Hitchens obituaries and quotes from him. He died recently. And he said, you should always write as if posthumously, i.e. without any thought of consequences or offence or comeback or being judged in any way. And that's what Louis C.K.'s comedy is like to me. He writes with a detachment of someone who's got no interest in maintaining status at all, you know.
Yes.
And it's not, and it seems so sincere on such a sort of existential level that he's prepared to throw himself away as a sort of being of value. He's not just saying, I'm fat, meaning like me.
Yeah.
You know, he's saying, I'm fat, look, I'm really disgusting, and so are you.
Yeah.
And it's, it's irresistible.
And do you have any, are there any sort of rituals that you perform prior to a gig? Are you in the habit of doing superstitious things or?
No, I don't suppose so. I mean, writing on one's hand is quite superstitious because one never actually looks at it. So that's my one superstition, I suppose. I suppose a few years ago I had kind of lucky t-shirts and that sort of thing.
Oh, really?
But I'm less fussed about that now. Yeah.
Oh, I'm good. I'm glad to hear someone say they've grown out of that.
Do you as well?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Certainly for, I've got little superstitions about the things I can have in my pockets when I go on. Can't have any money in my pockets because otherwise it's a day-to-day thing and this isn't day-to-day.
That's
so I always make sure I've got no money in my pockets.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And I will come out of gigs that went badly and then pat my pockets and go, oh, there we go, typical, it's a pound. I didn't make it.
Right.
I think that describes far too much.
No, that's very interesting because I have t-shirts that I have blamed.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I also have to have a pen as well, which I think stems from one open spot I did 5 years ago where I just improvised something which involved writing something on my hand or on someone else's hand.
Right.
And I thought, oh, it's a good job I had a pen in my pocket.
Yeah.
I've kept it in my pocket ever since.
Nice.
In the hope that I...
Like your own internal mother telling you this, always wear clean underwear.
Exactly. One of the things that I think people get really excited about in terms of comedy is hecklers and whether or not they are destructive or whether they can ever contribute and how people respond to them. I'm sure you've been in the situation, as have we all, of someone ruining your gig and then coming up to you afterwards and saying, hey, that was me.
Hey, buddy. We should go on tour together. Yeah.
Do you
despise those people. I wish they'd curl up and die. I think most comedians do. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's about it. I think if you want attention, then why don't you risk embarrassment?
Sure. But do you have a structure that you fall into dealing with a heckler?
I try not to, yeah. I mean, I'm quite disdainful about stock lines, but then I have my own stock lines that I use. But ideally, one would be witty. Heckling is not so bad. Well, it depends. I mean, it depends if you deserve it or not, i.e. if the crowd agree with you or agree with the heckler. If the crowd agree with you, well, it's party time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can just go to town, you know, if you have your wits about you. But those are great gigs, are mocking a heckler. I mean, mm-hmm. those are great moments, aren't they, for all mm-hmm. of us live, you know, when you win that it feels very fresh and victorious, and it wasn't for the taking, you know.
Yeah.
So that's
and this is this is the argument.
Yeah.
This is the argument I find myself having is that then the heckler can feel like they've been a sort of sacrificial lamb who's allowed you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank goodness I interjected because you got two great. Oh, that was the best bit was when you called me.
If you win and then they shut up after that, that's ideal.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's golden, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, often one shouldn't be too paranoid about heckling, because often it is exactly that. It's a sort of invitation, a kind of fannish invitation for you to prove yourself the reigning champ, and it can actually mm-hmm. be quite a complimentary spirit, you know, mm-hmm. rather than something mm-hmm. aggressive. Yeah.
Well, on that note of hopefully being a reigning champ, I think we
can. That's a good phrase to end on.
Yeah, man. Well,
ring in the air.
Tie that up there. You're going to Edinburgh this year. Hopefully, this will. I'm sure by August I can have put this out in some form. So you're going to be doing Jigsaw. Do you have any idea of a venue?
That's right. Well, we'll be in the Pleasance, hopefully Pleasance Courtyard, but we'll have to see. Yeah, that's not arranged yet.
And so hopefully, it's some sort of golden sketch time of between 3 and 5.
Yeah, sort of. I think
we could sort of guess where
five something, which is Sketch O'Clock, yeah, and it's a sweet time to do a sketch show. Yeah, it's good.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Tunnel.
Good.
We've just shaken hands. Mm-hmm. And we're out.
So that was Dan Antopolsky. You can find out more about him at danantopolsky.com and more about Jigsaw, his fabulous sketch show, at jigsawcomedy.com. So check out both of those. Jigsaw he does with Tom Crane and Nat Lertzimer, who are both fabulous comics in their own right. And I hope to get them in here. They've all got very different approaches. So with luck, we'll speak to the rest of them. And maybe we could get Tom and Nat in together and they could spend an hour slagging Dan off. Let's see if we can drive some cracks into a good sketch group. Speaking of sketch group, Pappies are going to come along and do the Comedian's Comedian Live at Edinburgh. So I cannot wait to talk to them. They are going to be just sweating everywhere. I imagine that's how it's going to work. I think I might have mentioned that last week. I can't think of Pappies without thinking about sweat and Advocaat. So, yes, thank you very much for listening. Remember to email me anything you like, nice stuff, weird stuff. Ever since I did Show Me the Funny last year, I seem to get a lot of weirdos emailing me every so often. So if you're one of them, why not email me again? You've got to love a weirdo. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't call you ladies and gentlemen. You, the listener, you. I am going to be back, you, next time in 2 weeks with Mr. Ben Norris. And that chat is, it's a great conversation. I've got it already in the can. It's very, very difficult to... Difficult? No, wrong. It's very different to the chat we've just had with Mr. Antopolsky. Ben is a live wire improvising kind of demon. And he's going to be talking about trying to get himself into the state where the demon comes out and he can just explode on stage. If you know Ben, and if you've ever been, specifically if you've ever been anywhere socially with Ben, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. All of that stuff is now becoming more and more part of his day-to-day stand-up performance. So really interesting conversation coming up there. Hope you listen to it. That's in 2 weeks. Get in touch. Thanks for downloading. That's all the things I have to say. Apart from, of course, thank you to Dan Melrose for the music, Graham Crockford for his support and technical assistance, Toby Rose for work on the website, and To Entertain and everyone there for their assistance throughout. Thanks very much. I'll see you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.